Hello and welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a weekly podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And this week, we're very pleased to have Andrew Knight join us to talk about translations. Hi, Andy.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Thank you for coming on.
There's a lot of things we want to talk to you about. The big one is translations, but perhaps we can start with your background. How'd you get into programming and your day job, which is also quite interesting.
Sure. Cool. So, man, I first started programming when I was in high school. Ninth grade, I went to Parkville High School in Baltimore, Maryland, Center for Math, Science, and Computer Science. And as part of joining that special program, you had to get the TI-83 Plus graphing calculator. And so here I am, I think, I'm going to be doing math, right? Because I've been told I'm good at math, and I don't really know what the world is like. And within the first 2 weeks of ninth grade, in my intro to computer science course, we're programming math formulas on the calculator. And I thought this was the coolest thing ever. And so I became addicted. I just kept making more and more formulas. I went to the back of my math textbook. I put in all the formulas I could. Then I started making games on the calculator. Then I started doing graphics things. I mean, this is, you know, a T83 Plus. It's nothing sophisticated. But then, thankfully, because my high school had computer science courses, in 10th grade, I learned to program Java. And then in 11th grade, I took the AP exam and the rest was history. I went to RIT, got my degree in computer science, and I've just loved doing it ever since. So that's how I got started.
Well, that's fantastic. You had it in high school. That's still quite unusual in the States. I recall the graphing calculators in math class. I think I'm a bit older than you are, but I think it was a TI-82 I had. And when I could download, not just Tetris was cool, but I was able to get Super Mario Brothers on there. And that felt, so I wasn't even trying to do formulas. I was just playing games. But that was quite fun. So you came out, and then what was your job cycle up until now?
My goodness. So when I went to school at RIT, they require every student to do internships. You don't graduate unless you do internships. It's pretty cool. And
that's
so
great.
That's how I landed in North Carolina. I've been in the Triangle area permanently for the past decade. I've worked at IBM, then NetApp, then, oh gosh, there's too many. MaxPoint Interactive, which got bought out by Velasys. Then LexisNexis, the legal software.
Yeah.
And today, for the past almost 2 years, I'm working at a company called PrecisionLender, which recently got acquired by Q2 Software. In my day-to-day job, I am a software engineer in test. So I focus heavily on testing, automation, better processes, team collaboration. I like to tell people when they ask, well, what is a software engineer in test? I develop solutions to testing problems. So, hey, we do nothing but manual testing. Solution, let's try to automate some of those tests. Problem,
right.
Hey, we're struggling to figure out what should be developed and what should be tested, and we don't have these specs. Okay, let's do some example mapping and let's do some Three Amigo sessions and actually come together as a team and plan before we code, that kind of stuff.
I guess two questions come to mind for me. The first is what technologies have you been using? Are you able to use Django, or it sounds like maybe not Django for these?
So yeah, it's great you asked that question. In my day job, I'm not using Django. I'm not even using Python. PrecisionLender is a Microsoft shop. So my testing and automation solution is developed in .NET, C#. The data scientists at PrecisionLender use Python. That side is all, you know. In fact, they've even done an internal side project where they're using a Django server to do some cool metadata stuff. But as far as me, all my Python and Django is kind of moonlighting.
And how long have you been doing the testing angle? Is that just at this most recent job, or have you been testing track since you came out of school?
I first touched testing and automation in 2007 with my first internship at IBM. But I came back to it, like, you know, full time, you know, never gone back since about 2011. That's when I got my job at NetApp, because they hired me on a QA team specifically because, oh, he's the new college grad. He's got all the programming skills. We'll just make him do all the scripting. That was basically the attitude. And so I spent 4 years at NetApp, and I basically had to rewrite the team's automation solution because it was rough. And yeah, so that's where I've been.
Now that you're a relative graybeard, well, how does that differ? Sorry, Carlton.
Well, I was going to just say that aren't all automation solutions kind of gnarly in exactly that way?
Oh, so yeah, I mean, I've I've had the pleasure of helping several companies, several teams. I've done my own consulting. And test automation code, I hate to say this, man, it's some scary stuff. Because a lot of people don't treat it like regular, quote-unquote, software, even though it is.
Yeah,
so a lot of best practices get jettisoned very quickly. People have this attitude that it's just writing test scripts. It's versus, you know, building a software stack and a solution that has to be maintainable, that has its own unique challenges. It's a domain, just like web development or microservices. Test automation is a special domain, and so you need to have a good expertise with it,
yeah,
like anything else.
So what does your testing look like within your side project Django apps? What sort of setup do you like to do?
Actually, with my Django apps, my Django
or just
apps
no testing at all.
No, yeah, no,
just
fly by the seat of your pants.
Well, because my Django apps that I've developed are actually pretty small, like I can talk about them a little bit later, but they are pretty small. So I don't do a lot of front end UI testing with them, because honestly, the Django apps I've made, the front end is just the admin, which is beautiful because it just gives you the front end that that I needed for my purposes. I'm like, yay.
And that has UI testing as part of the framework. So.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So it's like, I'm not going to repeat history there, but the testing that I do, I've done, a lot with the Django test client. I got to say that Django test client is lit. It gives you so much cool stuff. And so I've done like unit testing. I've done basic database testing, you know, setting up a test database and blowing it away. I've done, what else? You know, just basic utility function testing. I've tied it in with unit test. I've tied it in with PyTest. PyTest is lit. Love PyTest. So yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Do you use primarily PyTest or do you do a mixture?
I strongly, strongly advocate for PyTest. I believe very strongly that PyTest is a far superior framework than unit test. The one advantage unit test has, I think, maybe two. Two advantages unit test has. First of all, it's in the standard library, so you don't need to do a pip install to get it. Secondly, because it is in the traditional XUnit format, people coming from other languages like Java and C Sharp and whatever, they are immediately more familiar with unit test style tests.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't make it better. It just makes it easier for some people to come in.
But not just, I find it's not just people who are familiar with that. I think beginners find the way PyTest deals with fixtures difficult, and they create some sort of giant conf test file in the root of their test directory, and it's got all the fixtures in, and it's spaghetti, and it's difficult, right? And it's what I find unit test cases, they're really nice because they make you put the fixtures in the setup, in the scope, automatically scope just to that class. And as you come to use PyTest more, you learn, but I can just create a fixture in my test class that I'm grouping everything, and you can do the same thing. But it's not as automatic, I would say, with PyTest. There's not a pattern that's dictated to you.
Yeah. I could see that.
But PyTest, go, wee.
Yeah, I mean, I find that the fixtures are far more flexible and reusable than setup and cleanup methods. I find that the code is a lot cleaner when you're done with it. And the other thing I absolutely love about PyTest are the plugins. Like, you can just choose from a whole bunch of things. You want code coverage? Boom. You want reports? Boom. You want BDD with the same thing? Boom.
Yeah.
Oh, you want something that's not in there? Make it yourself. You know, it's. I think, like, I've dealt with tons of these test frameworks across all sorts of languages. Right now, today, my opinion is PyTest is the best framework for testing in any language today.
Super.
And I'll stand by that.
What would you change about PyTest just to, like, round out this conversation? Are there, because I've heard, for you, what areas would you change if you could about it?
What would I change about PyTest?
Especially given that you have such a broad experience of other testing, you know, ways outside of the Python ecosystem.
That's a great question. I never considered that. I'm not sure if there's much I would need to change in PyTest simply because you do have that plugin architecture where if you want to change something, you can. Maybe some quality of life things like making it easier. Well, no, never mind. That's covered by tags. Some of the naming of things like parameterize is British English, not English or American English.
Yeah, Carlton, boo.
Stuff like that.
Not English English, you nearly said that.
Yeah,
sorry,
yeah.
I know. I don't know. I always thought the name conftest.py was a little bit weird, you know. I do like how that one, though, can apply to different directory levels, which is nice.
Yeah, that's super. So, that's really super.
Yeah, yeah. So, they're like, the nice thing about PyTest is it's comprehensive and flexible, yet it still feels minimal. So I'm not sure there would be much I would want to change. At least not right now. Maybe I'll think about it and, you know, tomorrow I'll wake up and be like, oh, there's this thing, but
yeah, I think beyond the syntax, it's the fixture nature of PyTest that trips up beginners, in my experience, when they want to make that transition, just as you said, trying to figure out how to use them properly. The fact that you don't have to have one massive fixture. Mm-hmm. I mean, even just using fixtures, the concept of fixtures, if someone's learning on their own, is a foreign concept. So I agree with your, you know, that's the big leap for people when they jump to PyTest. And, mm-hmm. and you know, for me, at some point I'm going to release a course on just specifically Django testing. And that's one of the questions I'm asking myself is, what's that structure? Like, I'm probably going to start, go through Django tests and then probably have fixtures and then go to PyTest. So there's already some introduction to fixtures if that's new to people, and then kind of get into the plugins, but have that be more like where you go from here. The, you know, there's so many plugins for PyTest and everyone seems to kind of like their different flavors.
yep.
So definitely want to talk to you about translations, which was
sure.
I mentioned at the beginning. So you gave a talk, which we'll link to in the notes, at PyCascades recently.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we've got lots of questions. I'd love you to maybe tee up the talk and how it came about for you personally.
Sure. So I'll give the story. I'm from America. My wife is from China. And we've been married for coming up on 6 years now. My wife, since being in the United States, has been very entrepreneurial. She's always looking for, you know, ways she can employ herself, use her creative talents, do stuff. So she's done like a dance studio. She's done photography. And she's also done importing and exporting with China. We've imported custom-made, tailor-made suits and dresses. We've exported all different kinds of different goods and such. And so with that import-export business, she wanted a way to be able to track all of the orders to make it easy. She was using big, scary spreadsheets, and it was sloppy and all that stuff. Anytime you see the big, scary spreadsheet, software solution opportunity. Boom, there you go.
Yep.
So the first thing we did was the suits and dresses, but it moved on to other things. And so we wanted to make a better software solution for this. And we also wanted to enable her mom to be able to contribute to this as well. So my wife is bilingual, English Mandarin. I speak English. I can pretend to speak Chinese. And mama speaks Mandarin only. So problem. So I was thinking, okay, what's the best way to make this kind of software solution? And that's when I discovered the Django project. I was like, okay, well, here is a web application framework. It gives you the ORM for a database, and it will give you this admin site for your front end, where you can go in and manipulate the data models. It gives you the forms, and it also has that translation framework built into it. I'm like, this is perfect. So I built the application. I did the translations throughout the entire thing, and I deployed it to Heroku, and it's one of them is still being hosted there today.
Were you thinking you wanted to use Python, or is it just on its own Django? So this is the first time you used Django. I'm wondering why, or what else factored in? Was it, did you want to use Python, or was it really just knowing about the translation app and the admin said, oh, and knowing multiple languages, you're like, oh, that's a good reason to do Django Python?
Sure. I think it was both. It was both the language as well as the framework itself. Because this was, gosh, I don't even remember. I want to say this was like 2016 when I started this journey, so to speak. I had done Python at MaxPoint at that time. In fact, I had done Python in high school way long ago, like 2005, 2006. It was 2.4, 2.5-ish, I think, at that time. I can't remember. And then I had left Python, never touched it again until I went to MaxPoint in 2015, and I started doing it again, and I fell in love. I was like, this language is great. And then with that in mind, when I went into looking at, okay, I need to develop a web application for these side businesses that we're partnering up with, what's the best thing out there? And I had not done web development myself at that point. I had tested web apps, but I had not done web development. And so it was all new to me. And I'm like, well, what web frameworks are out there? And so you Google and you see things like Angular and React, maybe. I don't even remember if at that time they were out. I think Angular was. But I was looking at
things. I think React came out 2015, 16.
Yeah, yeah. So those were kind of like new, hot off the press. So I was looking at those, and then I saw Django and I saw Flask. I'm like, you know, this Django thing looks pretty good. And I know Python. Python's awesome. So I started doing like a feature comparison, and that's when Django just blew it away, because it's like it has everything I need and it's easy and there's tutorials online from the official documentation. And so I've ripped through that tutorial, and that's how I learned Django. That was kind of like the test case of, is this really what I think it is? And it was. And I'm like, done. So I decided Django it is, never looked back.
Yep, fair enough.
For listeners who haven't used translations, I liked in your talk, you kind of broke down the workflow into, I think it was four different parts.
Yes, yes. So let's see if I can recall this off the top of my head. The four stages of translation are, first you have to prepare your settings PY file. There's some bitawares, there's some options, some paths you I don't want to say need to set, but should set, to just kind of prepare your Django application. The second part would be then setting up your URL routing. Django has a nifty feature where you can have these language prefixes in your URL so that if you want to force it to go to a Chinese page, you can just shove that in the URL and it navigates right there. The third step is marking all of your strings in your application for translation. That's the most painful part.
Yeah.
If you are starting a greenfield project up from scratch and you have that in mind, it's not as difficult because it's a tax as you go kind of thing. Like, oh, well, yeah, of course these model names need to be translated. And of course these view strings need to be translated. But if you already have an established project and you're going back and trying to find everything,
right.
Ooh, especially if your project's of any size, yeah. Ooh, that can be rough. The fourth bit is actually making those message files. You run a basic Django command. It gives you the templates for them. And the message files are basically a one-to-one mapping. You have a string in either the language you wrote or a token that you've used for the application front end. And then it gives you an empty string for what the translation is for that particular locale. And you've got to put that in. Django doesn't give you Chinese. So there were many, many nights on the couch where I would be working on this thing. I'd say to my wife, hey, hon, can you please translate these strings for me?
Yeah.
My personal experience with translations is this: there's a website called Quizlet, and I led the translation of it into a bunch of languages. And the interesting thing was figuring out, especially when it's a language like Chinese, which is one of the ones we did, you know, what is that string like length? Is it, can you just do a phrase? Mm. Can you do a word? Can you do a sentence? I'm curious, you know, how you've learned doing that, right? Because it's one thing to, maybe you could change the word the directly translate, but if it's a phrase or it's slang, that's kind of where it gets a little bit harder to decide, right? Like,
absolutely. Yeah, I always did at the phrase level. Thankfully, I never had a lot of long text to translate, but even in the times I did, I would just use, you know, the full thing. Because if you try to piece it word by word and try to splice that together, the grammar's not going to be right. It's going to be what? It's going to be weird. So always, always at the phrase level, what are you trying to say? Translate based on that intention.
And Carlton, have you dealt with translations personally in the Django realm? I think
yes,
right?
I've used it, but not on personal sites. Okay. On client sites, used translation, but things. And the issue is exactly right: marking the translation strings, and then in my experience, you'd always hire out. There are agencies that will, and they do a great job. I can't remember any off the top of my head, but they do a really good job. You outsource your string files with the target languages, and they will go and recruit, you know, people. And that's a very scalable way of doing it, and, you know, quite affordable, really, given what you're trying to achieve. If I was building my own site, I'd be able to translate it into Catalan or Spanish, but beyond that, I'd need outside help.
Well, and then there's the phases, too, of, I guess this would apply more to a larger scale site, of, so you do the first wave of translations, but then sites change, and then figuring out how, you know, tip of the spear are you with the translations? Do you do it monthly? Do you say certain number of new text? Do you kick it over? Those are sort of the maintenance realm questions that kind of come up. But I guess that's not really Django specific, but more just something that happens also in these projects that you may not think about it up front.
I will say Django does make it very easy to identify new strings. because when you go to regenerate those meshes, when you go to regenerate those message files, the new strings are always, I believe, like popped at the bottom or something, or you can do like a quick control F and see all the empty or the fuzzies. So it's very, very easy just to rerun that command and just see all the new stuff pop out so that you're not missing anything. Recently within Precision Lender, the company where I work, in the past year or two, they had to do translations for our application. And it was a nightmare of work because it's a huge application, so many places. And even to this day, we still struggle with missing tokens, right? Well, somebody will pop in a new token on the front end, but because there's no mechanism to just scrape the entire application and find all of those, it's really just up to the quote unquote best practice for the developer to, you know, add it, I believe, to notify somebody to say, hey, we need a translation for this thing.
And of course, they get missed, right?
And that's why I was asking you, Carlton. I actually haven't used Django, the translation app, myself. So that's kind of why I was teeing up the earlier question to you.
No, I mean,
about using.
You know, for my own personal sites, I'm very lazy and I don't put it on. I probably should, but
the sign of a good programmer: practice laziness. Yeah.
The reality is I'm not going to translate my own personal site, you know, my own personal project. But if it's a work project, then, you know, more or less now, it's kind of compulsory. I mean, it has been for a long time. But since mobile apps came along, you know, and app stores put it in, you know, so many countries, it's just become widespread. It's become, you know, if you're going to do business in Europe, you need English, you need Spanish, you need French, you need German, you need Dutch, you need Hungarian, you need, you know, the 27 member states, they've all got their own languages.
Well, and one thing that's changed, and at least since I was working on Quizlet a number of years ago, was the, you know, browser level automatic translations, especially if you're using Chrome, are quite good, actually. Like, this is for me with my work, where I write books, I have them as PDFs right now. I'm moving that all online in part because people can translate it. So, you know, it's not perfect, but they can get a lot of the way there in a way that I would like to have translated versions of my books, but I update them all the time. And that's sort of like a nice hack at my low level. But if I was a company, you know, I would want to do formal translations as opposed to in-browser.
Well, it's cool.
But that's something that's
quality,
it's pretty powerful, actually. I mean, I use it sometimes.
It's like that quality feel. Well, what's if that? You're a company, you want that sort of quality feel. And, like, you know.
Yeah. You can tell that it's a little hacky, yeah. Another point you made in your talk that I really liked was localization versus internationalization. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could...
Sure.
What's the difference between the two? Because they sound the
same. Yeah. And actually, a lot of times people use them interchangeably. But if you want to nuance those terms, localization is the process of fitting an app to a specific locale, usually a locale being like a country. So a good example of locale versus language would be British English versus American English versus Australian English, right? Or Spain Spanish versus Mexican Spanish, right? Those are the same language, but they're different locales. And so usually when we say locale, it is a difference between like English and Spanish or English and Chinese, but it can be small things like phrases or spelling. Locale also includes things like date format.
Yeah.
Right. Do you put the month first or do you put the day first?
Right.
It could include other things beyond just linguistic things. Things like are certain pictures or gestures or things taboo in another culture?
Yeah.
Right. Well, the mapping companies certainly know how to do that.
Yeah. One that I always like to think of, because I'm a video gamer. Well, maybe not as much as I used to be. I'm a Nintendo fanboy. And Nintendo always removes religious references when they send stuff to the United States. So anything with like a cross shape on it, that's scrubbed out for localization.
Oh, but in Japan,
it,
I guess,
it just flies.
Or wherever it's not.
Yeah. So that would be an example of a non-linguistic localization. So now comparing that to internationalization. Internationalization refers more to the tools and the frameworks and the processes for doing localization. So the localization would be, it, if you think about it, the artifacts, whereas the internationalization is more of the process and the platform. So internationalization could be something like the fact that Django provides a translation framework, and the localization would be my Mandarin Chinese message files.
That's helpful. That's definitely something I've confused those phrases myself.
And, if you go back to your four steps, Ernie, like the internationalization is the first couple, right? You do the settings, you mark the strings for translation, and then the localization is the latter steps.
Mm-hmm. Correct. That's a great way to see it. I didn't even think about that. I should update that, because I've given this talk at the PyCon virtual conference thing. The first three steps would be internationalization, and the fourth step would be the localization. That's great. That's a great way to frame it. I'm gonna take that.
No problem.
In terms of testing your translations, is it just basically you can see what? So there's two levels. One is just seeing string or token hasn't been translated, which I assume you can sort of see like a coverage version. And I guess that's the one you have to focus on, because the other is qualitative and it'd be a bit challenging.
So that testing localization is actually a great, or I should say testing translations, to be correct with terms. That is a very, very interesting aspect for testing, and specifically testing and automation, because there's so many layers to it. Like the first thing would be testing the internationalization. Does your application actually have the mechanisms in place to flip from, say, Chinese to English and back again, right? So there's that kind of testing that has to happen. Because if you think it's being translated into Chinese, but it's not, and it's at the framework level, ooh, that's a problem. Now, thankfully, Django, I'm assuming Django has test cases, unit tests for that somewhere buried in the framework. I haven't looked at the source code of that.
I mean, it must for that.
No, I mean, we test things like, for instance, when you put in the language prefixed into the URL, you know, is that respected? And then what's the active language inside the test case at that point? And I kind of, you know, all of those stuff is quite robustly tested, because it's hard.
So when we talk about the URLs, so for example, if it's example.com, it'd be like slash, you know, GB if it's Great Britain English, whereas it'd be slash, I don't know, BR for Brazilian Portuguese, right? That's kind of what we're talking about in terms of why you're configuring the URLs.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Just for, you know, whereas if you were in a, I suppose if you were in a single page application setting, you might just have it all being AJAX loaded. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't need the different URLs.
Correct.
But it seems simpler to me anyways to have it in the URLs.
You can do it by the user preference as well. So depending on there are various ways of configuring it, but you can have it such that the same URL will serve multiple languages depending on what the user set by. You could set a cookie or something in the session to give them a language option.
Because you can sniff and you can see in their browser. You can see their default browser setting.
Browsers have preferences as well. And Django falls back through. There's a various ordering as to which one it will.
Yes.
It will accept. You know, it will fall back to the browser preference, but then the URL or the cookie, or I'd need to go and look at the source code to remember the exact ordering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all in that middleware. And I should also say, you're not required to do the URL language prefix in Django. It's more of an optional thing you can add on if you so choose. I just find it to be very, very helpful. And so that's why I always recommend it.
So that was phase one of the testing.
Yeah, so your first thing would be making sure your framework is doing the language stuff, that internationalization stuff correctly. Then even though Django would handle most of that, you would still want to do things like, hey, if you are limiting your available languages, you'd want to have a few test cases for that. Like in Django, you have that languages option in the settings PY that if you set that, it will say it will only serve these sets of languages and anything else is errored out, I believe.
Well, full back
to the default.
So
you might want to have a few tests against that just to make sure that, you know, that's good to go. And if somebody changes something, you know, all that kind of stuff. The next type of translation testing would be a visual test. And that would be to make sure that you actually have the page you have all of these strings being translated on your page. So when I was doing English to Chinese, it was very easy for me because I can read English, I can't read Chinese. So I would do manual testing, load the page, switch it to Chinese. If I can read anything on the page, then I've missed something.
Yeah.
Now, that's something that is very, very difficult to do with traditional automation, because what are you going to do? You're going to scrape every single field? Mm-hmm. That's a case where visual testing is a much, much better solution. So there are tools out there, like Selenium Base has a screenshot and comparison function. Excuse me. You can pay for a tool as a service like AppleTools, where they'll take snapshots of your application and then compare them over time and use AI to try to find the most critical parts, just kind of flag you to say, hey, was this changed and it seems critical? Can you give a thumbs up or thumbs down? So that's where that kind of testing, I think, would be very, very useful for automating language translation on a live application. Because it's like, oh, it's right there, boom. Visual is the way to go, because clearly if you have English words versus Spanish words versus French words, they're going to appear very differently to a machine, but you may gloss over with your eyes as a manual tester. And then, yeah, the third thing would be the qualitative test. Do the language phrases you put in make sense? And you really need somebody who's fluent in that language to look at it and be like, hey, this ain't right. And I've had that happen a couple times, because context is so important with your translations, right? When you send off those language files, those messages files, right? Sometimes it may only be a single word or maybe a small phrase isolated from everything else. And you give it to, I would give it to my wife and say, here, translate this phrase. And she would translate it. And then that language file with that translation would get sucked up into the application. I'd deploy it out there in Heroku and say, okay, here's the page. Does it look good? And she'd be like, what the hell is this field? What? That doesn't make any sense. And it's like, well, what do you mean? You gave me the translation. And she's like, well, no, it really should be this instead. It's like, okay, there's your qualitative test.
Yeah. One thing, you just quick point that comes up, is one thing you can do is when you're marking your strings for translation, you can add a special translator's comment, which appears in the string file, that they can then, it gives a bit of context. You say, look, this is appearing here, or try to keep this short, or, you know.
Sure.
Which is kind of handy, but it's...
Oh, very nice.
We're short of getting a native speaker to look at your result and tell you if it's any good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's no solution, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Carlton, do you know, is the perhaps most likely Django historian in this chat, when translation was added?
No, like Django, ages ago, long, long time ago.
I don't actually know who's responsible for it. I mean, it's one of those black box parts of Django to me.
I'd have to go and ask some of the old hands exactly the story there. But it's been there for ages and ages and ages and ages and ages, like a decade, like more and more.
Wow.
Okay. I was going to add... for listeners who want to see an example specifically of it changing in the URL routes, the site listennotes.com, we had the founder Wen Ben on. He's got a really nice homepage, and at the bottom, you can scroll down and cycle through, it's like 20 different languages, and you can see both that the URL changes at the top, there'll be a slash, and then the language prefix, and then also you can see that the text changes. And so... Because I'm assuming your site is like a private one, Andrew.
Yeah.
Or we could share yours as well if you'd like.
Well, it is private. So.
Okay. Yes. But Listen Notes is a really good example of it.
And the Django docs, of course, docs.djangoproject.com.
Oh, yeah.
They're translated into, you know, what, 7-8 languages.
Hadn't even thought of that. And the source code for that is available. Yeah. Oh, good call, Carl.
Yeah. But Django. Why did we think of that? Like. What's
way to represent?
There are dogs.
It actually makes me. I haven't actually looked at it, but I've also, you know, I wonder if, you know, when the way Django also does the version numbers, where you can click through and it changes, that seems like that'd be a mutation of the language framework. But I don't know how it's actually implemented. It's a very similar.
Yeah.
Setup,
so there's the language prefix, and then there's the version prefix, and then inside that is the docs for each particular. Particular build. But, like, you know, going back to, well, what's it, if I click on the versions, going back to 1.8, you can see there, and then all the languages going back to 1.8 are live, and then the development version is only in English. That will be translated for 3.1 when we tag 3.1, when we branch 3.1.
Who does those translations?
Right. So this is a really good question, because while we have people listening, there's a translations team, an internationalization team, a translations team that you can join and contribute, and you can help translate the strings inside the Django framework and the docs as well. And we can have more docs versions, but they need to be translated into the languages, and they need to be, I think, 70 or 80% complete before we'll put that new version up. So if you want your language, you know, come and join the team. If you go to the list of mailing lists, there's an internationalization mailing list that you can join. It's just a Google group. You can say, hey, I'd like to volunteer. And it's all run on a thing called TransFX, which is a service which enables you to log in and you can translate individual strings and collaborate on that translation. And yeah.
We'll put a link to that in the notes. And we should actually...
come and join in.
It's interesting now that I'm on the Django board, so instead of saying, oh, someone should do something or other, it's like, I should do it. One thing I really do want to do is write some blog posts, official blog posts, talking about these various teams that we have and the people who do unsung work. So translations, the ops team, the security team. I'm sure there's other teams I'm not thinking of, more just to let people know and do little call outs to folks, because I've dealt with the ops and security team quite a bit recently, and you know, they do a ton of work but most people don't know about it. Same with translations. So note to self, I need to write those blog posts and also, make it let people know, like, you don't just have to sit there and say, I wish Django was translated into this language. Like you can help.
Yeah. And
great. Okay. So we'll link to that.
It's very knowledgeable people that have been doing it for a long time that head up that effort and
Yeah. Perhaps we could have one of them on too. There was one more thing, Andy, I wanted to ask you about, and then obviously whatever you want to talk about. So PyCarolinas, you've been involved
trying
in work around that?
Yeah.
What's the context for that?
Sure. So little bit of history. There's only ever been one PyCarolinas, and that was way before I was back into Python. It was 2012. It was held here in the Triangle. It was at UNC. Very small conference. Nice. Calvin Spielman was the chair. Iron Froggy on Twitter. Then his life changed, never happened again, so be it. Then in 2016, we had a PyData conference here in the Carolinas. And the only reason I even knew about that was because my company, MaxPoint, was one of the top-level sponsors. It was here in Research Triangle Park. IBM was the main sponsor of it. There were like 300, 400, maybe 500 people. It was a good size. And that was actually the first conference that I spoke at. I gave a talk on Python testing because my company at the time was like, everybody submit to speak. I'm like, okay. And I just got accepted because the testing talks are always the token talks at Python conferences, and you always get at least one. So boom, and nobody else really submits for them. Don't take my secret. But
right.
Sorry, anyway.
Making notes.
I really, really got involved in the Python community starting in 2018. That's when I spoke at PyCon the first time. It's when I went to PyOhio, PyGotham, PyCon Canada. I've been addicted to these things. Been going all over the world for Python conferences. But at PyCon 2019, I was thinking to myself, you know, it'd be really cool if we had a Python conference in the Carolinas again. And I was talking with some other people from the Carolinas. They're like, yeah, we should do that. We should do that. And I'm like, okay, well, I guess it's a duocracy, so I might as well try to make this happen. So I went to an open space for conference organizers, and I just wanted to learn what it means to run a conference. And then Dustin Ingram, who was leading that open space, he comes up to me afterwards and is like, hey, Andy, do you want to announce a call to action to get a PyCarolinas going tomorrow on stage in front of like 1,000 people? And I say, yes, because I was so excited at the time. So I get up on stage and I make the call to action. Please help me get this PyCarolinas thing going. I got in touch with Calvin. I met him. And so, yeah, we've been trying to get it going, but it's been a little bit tough because life.
Well, right? Yeah.
I'm already uber busy with so many things. But we have some organizers together. We have a lot of people excited. We have a venue. It'll be in Raleigh. It's scheduled for June 20th. We'll see with coronavirus how that goes. It's going to be somewhere between 100 and 200 people. The original view was to make it like a 2-day traditional, you know, Python regional conference. But given the whole coronavirus mess and the fact that we hadn't organized a whole lot because we've been busy, I decided to change up the format to make it an unconference. So one day, lightning talks only. There'll be a sign up ahead of time, but no official call for proposals, no big review committee. Not looking to have like a huge expo area. Basically, it's going to be Lightning Talks and Open Space and Collab Clusters. And then we'll have maybe a few sponsors, you know, somebody for lunch. Red Hat is our sponsor for the venue, that kind of stuff. Keep it small so that if we need to postpone it, it'll be easy,
yeah.
Right? That's kind of the vision we have for Pi Carolinas right now. I'm still hopeful that we can pull it off. I have just a few small little tasks left to get the official website out the door. I've developed it using Flask with Zappa and Amazon Web Services so that it's all serverless, just kind of push it out there and boom!
You're a madman. Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Well, because spinning up an EC2 instance was too hard.
Well, I mean...
No, I'm joking.
I mean, I'm admiring you. I mean, Zappa is one of those things, too. I see talks, and I briefly tried, and I was just like, oh, my God, like, until I have to, I won't. But
yeah, I mean, it was really easy getting the thing out there just as a function. I mean, I have the development one out there. It's just a really ugly URL. The only thing that I haven't done yet is connected to the PyCarolinas.org domain. That's one of those things where I'm just like, don't have time right now. Yep. It's been about a week
of no
time.
Well, if you want to do that before we... launch this episode, we'll put a link to one of them in the notes.
Sure.
Either
good.
The official,
yeah. I'll get on that.
that's one of the things about web that I just every time I have to just grit my teeth when I'm dealing with DNS
mm-hmm.
stuff. It's
mm-hmm.
I don't know about
yeah,
you
no
Carlton,
it's horrible it's horrific.
Like it's because it's not hard, it's just frustrating, and because of the timing, like I never know, it's like, did it work, did it not work? Is it because either it happens like in 10 seconds or it's like 48 hours for no reason.
Boom.
And it just takes like a week every time I need to do something or other like that.
You know, you've got a day-long TTL and you type one character wrong and you hit submit and you've and it's like, no!
Yeah.
And that happens every time.
And even just custom domains, like I had a whole chapter in my Django for Professionals book on how to do this, because it's such a pain. But it's like every provider is, you know, who's got your domain is different, and you know, Heroku is, I don't know, could be clearer. And it's a shame though, because even for me, right, like, you know, it's like every year or two I'm like, oh, how do I do this?
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
So
many things.
I understand it's not just like flipping the switch to
So I'll get on that.
Well, is there anything else you want to mention or plug as we wrap up here? So you're Automation Panda on Twitter. You're active there. You have your website. What's the best way for someone to get in contact with you if they have questions?
Yeah, yeah. So
or...
if you need to get in contact with me, I would recommend either Twitter at Automation Panda. You can go to my blog, automationpanda.com. There's a contact form in there. Or if you happen to be at your local Python conference, maybe I'll be there too. DjangoCon is going to be in October this year, right?
In principle, yes.
True?
Which one?
US.
The US one?
Yeah, DjangoCon US, sorry.
That's the plan.
Okay,
yeah. Cool. San Diego as well.
Yeah, I'm hoping to come to that one, but we'll see.
And DjangoCon Europe has been rescheduled for September.
Yeah, currently. I mean, you know, all these plans are dependent on, you know, the coronavirus, obviously, and we'll see how that goes.
And maybe a quick shout out on, you know, Django News. I run a newsletter, django-news.com, that has weekly news on Django, including updates on conferences and things like that. So that's a good resource for people if they're not aware of it. Well, Andy, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and share what you've learned.
Super.
I really,
really interesting. Thank you, Andy.
Thank you for inviting me. This was a lot of fun.
All right. And everyone, we're at ChatDjango on Twitter and djangochat.com. We'll see you
Join
all next
time. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.